Hello, I'm Penelope Lively, and you're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello, and welcome to a very special edition of Read On. I'm your host, Red Sale, and today we'll preview the five great novels contending for the Golden Man Booker Prize. Since it was first awarded in 1969, the Man Booker Prize has become the leading award for quality books published in the English language. To celebrate its 50th anniversary, the Booker Foundation has launched the Golden Man Booker Prize to crown the best work of fiction from the last five decades. All 51 past winners were considered by a panel of five specially selected judges, each of whom was asked to read the winning novels from one decade of the prize's history. Their Golden Five, the books they judged to have best stood the test of time, was announced at the Hay Festival back in May. But the overall winner will be chosen by the public. For the past month, readers have been invited to cast their vote on the Man Booker website, and the result will be announced at a glittering event on Sunday the 8th of July. Thanks to a long-standing agreement between RNIB and the Booker Foundation, all the books in contention are available in Braille, giant print, and as talking books from the RNIB library, so that readers with sight loss can also ponder alongside the judges who the winner should be. Now sit back and enjoy this Read On special guide to the Golden Man Booker Prize. The novel chosen to represent the first decade of the Man Booker Prize is In a Free State by V.S. Naipaul. It won in 1971. Here's Robert McCrum on why he chose In a Free State as his nominee for the Golden Man Booker Prize.
In this country, in Africa, there was a president and there was also a king. They belonged to different tribes. The enmity of the tribes was old, and with independence, their anxieties about one another became acute. Well, I find it very interesting because the 1970s was the decade when I sort of came of age as a reader. So I'm going back to my early 20s, books which I remember as being very important to me when I was growing up. And so it's like stepping back in time. It's like meeting my old self. It's been strange, but very, very interesting. I mean, Naipaul, I think, is for all time. And this is a great book. It's strangely thrilling, it's also modern, it's marvellously written, it's just a masterpiece. And I think it's like a masterclass in contemporary fiction by somebody who is at the top of his game.
The novel consists of three short stories framed by a prologue and epilogue. In the first story, an Indian servant working in Washington, D.C., runs away from his master, gains American citizenship, but feels that he has lost his freedom. The second follows the story of a young Indo-Caribbean man jailed in London for murder, who feels no sense of ever having belonged anywhere. The third story is set in Africa. As the country around them slides into tribal conflict, two English visitors, thrown together by circumstance, endure a long drive to reach the safety of their compound. The talking book version is read by Marvin Kane.
It was only a two-day crossing from Piraeus to Alexandria, but as soon as I saw the dingy little Greek steamer, I felt I ought to have made other arrangements. Even from the quay it looked overcrowded, like a refugee ship. And when I went aboard, I found there wasn't enough room for everybody. There was no deck to speak of. The bar, open on two sides to the January wind, was the size of a cupboard. Three made a crowd there, and behind his little counter, the little Greek barman, serving bad coffee, was in a bad mood. Many of the chairs in the small smoking room, and a good deal of the floor space, had been seized by overnight passengers from Italy, among them a party of overgrown American schoolchildren in their mid-teens, white and subdued, but watchful.
Like all the books on the Golden Man Booker shortlist, In a Free State by V.S. Naipaul is available from the RNIB library. The talking book version is TB 1832. You're listening to a special edition of Read On, celebrating the Golden Man Booker Prize. Still to come, a book that was adapted into an Oscar-winning film and an author who has won the Booker Prize twice. But first, poet Lem Sisse was given the task of selecting the best book from the 1980s, and he's chosen Moon Tiger by Penelope Lively. In his judges' comments, he calls it a unique book about an unpredictable woman way ahead of her time and yet absolutely of her time. Here he tells us why.
Padre setting up altar for Sunday service in the back of a 10-ton lorry, tailboard let down, men standing round in a half circle, apologetic, unsynchronised, murmur of prayers and hymns, column of armoured cars moving past behind, God being said, of course, to be on our side. You know, judging this particular decade, the 1980s, there were some big books in there. People should read Penelope Lively because I think this book now is more relevant than it was when it was a Booker Prize winner in the 1980s. The writing is sublime, the detail is exquisite, the storytelling is masterful. I feel like I understand so much more having read this book.
Now, Dame Penelope Lively is the author of many prize-winning novels and collections of short stories for adults and for children. She was twice nominated for the Man Booker Prize before winning it in 1987 for Moon Tiger. It's a haunting tale of loss, loneliness, and secret desire, with a complex, compelling, and unforgettable protagonist. So I was delighted when Penelope Lively invited me round to discuss the book. Dame Penelope Lively, welcome to Read On.
Well, thank you for having me, and it's a pleasure. It seems strange to me to be talking about this book, Moon Tiger, because I feel now as though someone else wrote it. It is over 30 years. And so in a sense, of course, I was someone else. You know, the writer I was 30 years ago is very different from the very much older writer that I am now. So I look back at it with interest, and I can remember writing it. The sort of central part of the book is set in the Libyan desert during the Second World War. I'd always wanted to write about that time and place because I was born and grew up in Egypt and I was there all through the Second World War. But of course, as a child, I was nine at the time of the events of the book in the Battle of Alamein. And for many years, I'd been wanting to write about this somehow, but couldn't see a way to do it. And eventually, I think it was probably after my first visit to Egypt as an adult, I sort of got the idea for it. And really, it's the story of the life of the narrator who's dying. She's an elderly woman. She's called Claudia Hampton, and she's dying in hospital, and she starts off by saying, "I'm writing a history of the world." She's very sort of, how can I describe her? She's very feisty. She's very opinionated. She's clever. After the book came out, I was always being asked if Claudia was me, and I felt like saying, "If only." She's not really like me at all, but. And I don't know if I'd have liked her if I'd known her. Interestingly, readers of the book were rather divided into men tended to either like her very much or to absolutely hate her. Women, on the whole, did like her, which I think said more about men really than about anything. And so the book is her story, and it's about her, how, as a war correspondent during the war, she goes out to Egypt and reports on the Libyan campaign, where she meets an army officer called Tom, and he is the great love of her life. But I won't spoil it for anyone who might want to read the book by saying what happens. And then it continues further into her later life with her relationship with her brother, which is very central, and with various others. So that really is the background and the story. And as I say, I can remember some of the writing of it because it obviously required a lot of research, and I hate research to show in a novel, so I was very intent that it shouldn't show. But I spent a lot of time in the Imperial War Museum looking at the mute, unedited film that they have of all the campaigns of the Second World War, so that you can literally see the Battle of Alamein. But it's mute, it's unedited, so you don't know exactly what it is that you're looking at. It was the basic material that was used for the pathé pictorial news films, of the news reporting films of the time. And I also, of course, read everything that I could about the campaign. But a great deal of it, I know, did come from my own childhood memories of the place, obviously not of the battlefront, because I'd never been there, but of Cairo itself, of the smells, the feel of it, the sound of it, the sight of it. I feel that without that, I could have written the book, but it would have been a rather different book. It would have lacked an element, I think. So, you know, to that extent, a sort of kind of personal experience went into it. And there it is. It's rather nice to see it having this sort of second life so many years later.
I came to reread it 31 years after I first read it as a rather callow youth. And I was astounded by how little the passage of time had affected it. It's still a very fresh, very appropriate book for our age. Claudia Hampton is a woman both of her time and rather before her time. She's a feisty proto-feminist, I suppose.
I think you can say that, yes. I mean, a lot of comments of that kind were made, yes. I hadn't thought of it that way at all. I mean, it was a time when feminism was being much talked about, but I certainly wasn't creating her as a sort of advance guard feminist. She was simply the kind of character that I wanted for this book. She was the protagonist that I needed for the book. So thus she came out like that. And I'm glad to hear you say that it does still feel kind of fresh. I haven't read it through myself end to end again ever, but every now and then, and particularly in the years after it won the Booker, and I used to have to talk about it a lot, I used to go to it to look up bits, and it's an extraordinarily difficult book to find your way around in. You can never find the place you want. One reason for that is that I was using a technique where in several places the same scene is seen through different eyes, is narrated through different eyes, so that you get the same scene two or three times, but seen from different points of view. I have to say, this passed one or two readers by. I did get one or two letters saying, did you realise that you've got the same scene twice in your book?
And yet that's a technique that I know is used in television and radio drama nowadays. So again, rather before its time. It's not a book that feels experimental, though. It's a book that feels actually quite comfortable in its own skin. It is a damn good read. And I think it attracted some criticism at the time as being the housewife's choice. But I remember my mum saying, well, if it's the housewife's choice, that means the housewife is right about what's good literature. Do you think actually now it's rather come of age?
I don't know. I mean, I still get a lot of letters about it. And interestingly, they come from all age groups. I don't think it's ever been particularly, you know, a middle-aged read or an elderly read. It can equally be a young read, which is what I feel any book should be. You know, if a book works, it's got to appeal to all age groups, and I hope that worked. Of course, again, that's not something you think about when you're writing the book. You don't think about anything except what you're doing in the book. You're not thinking, you know, I want this to appeal to housewives or whatever. You're just doing what's necessary for the story and for the characters and so forth. So the only thing I do know is that I couldn't write it now. So there is a sense in which, yes, somebody else did write it. I was about 50 at the time. And I think actually that the 50s are a bit more than 50 probably. The 50s are a good time for a writer. It's a good decade. You know, you've settled into what you're doing. You know what it is you're trying to do. You've had some practice. You've had successes. You've had failures. And it's often seemed to me that certainly for me it was a productive decade, and I've often noticed that it is for other writers as well. I think you write well at that point. Some people do their first book when they're very young, you know. I think that could probably be rather disastrous, to have written your one hugely successful book when you're young and then go on with others that are not seen as so successful. To any writers who might be listening and who are much less than 50, I would say bide your time. The best is yet to come.
You started your career writing young adult fiction, and actually that's where you won your first awards, I believe, the Carnegie Medal in 1973. And The Whitbread a few years after that. Did you always feel comfortable moving between age groups? I know some of your books are for much younger readers, but did you feel you had to wear a different hat for writing young adult fiction and general fiction?
Not really, no. I mean, it's a sort of gear change. I mean, I always felt when I was writing for children that the one thing you mustn't do is patronise children. You don't write down to children, because they're, as it were, sort of novice readers and second-class citizens. You don't produce a different kind of writing for them. You make adjustments. And so I found that in writing for children, particularly when writing for older children, I was writing out of the sort of adult interests and concerns that I would then later be writing adult novels from, the operation of memory and this kind of thing. So it wasn't, you know, far from a different kind of writing. Yes, there are some things that you can't write about children. Obviously, you know, the more mature aspects of life you can't write about for children, but you can write about almost anything. I've never written fantasy for adults. I've never had any interest in writing fantasy for adults, but I did for children. I didn't quite know why that should be. There's a book called The Ghost of Thomas Kemp, which is fantasy of a kind. That, again, has had a very long life. It's still very much around, which I'm glad of. And that's, you know, a world away from Moon Tiger. It's a very different kind of book, but it comes out of the same mind and the same set of interests.
Are you still writing?
I am, yes. I was 85 this year, and the only people who don't retire, I think, are writers, or painters often don't, and of course actors don't. It's in the arts, the sort of self-employed arts, that there's no retirement set. And I am writing a novel, but it's going extremely slowly, so whether it will finish first or I will finish first, heaven only knows.
What did winning the Booker Prize in 1987 mean to you?
Well, it meant a lot back then, as it still does. I wasn't expected to win. I wasn't the favourite. So I went to the evening not expecting to. But I remember at lunchtime, my husband had said, I don't think you're going to win, but just in case you do, you'd better think of something to say. So I suppose I did. And yes, it made a difference then. It meant for the next year or two, I was very busy sort of doing things in relation to it, going around the world for the British Council and that kind of thing. So it took away an awful lot of time. I remember thinking rather desperately, when am I going to be able to get back to writing another book, which is what I really want to be doing. And, well, this recognition by Lem Sisay choosing it as his choice out of the decade he was given as a judge, the 1980s. I'm amazed, and it's very nice. I'm delighted. I would be very leery of actually winning it, because inevitably whatever book wins it will be criticised for not being XYZ other books. So I'm not sure about winning it, but it's very nice to be shortlisted.
Very many congratulations for being shortlisted. And Dame Penelope Lively, thank you very much for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm writing a history of the world, she says. And the hands of the nurse are arrested for a moment. She looks down at this old woman, this old ill woman. Well, my goodness, the nurse says. That's quite a thing to be doing, isn't it? And then she becomes busy again. She heaves and tucks and smooths. Upsy a bit, dear, that's a good girl. Then we'll get you a cup of tea. A history of the world. To round things off. I may as well. No more nitpicking stuff about Napoleon, Tito, the Battle of Edge Hill, Hernando Cortez. The works this time. The whole triumphant, murderous, unstoppable shoot. From the mud to the stars, universal in particular. Your story and mine.
Norma West narrating Moon Tiger, written by my guest Penelope Lively. Moon Tiger is TB6649 and one of a wide selection of Penelope Lively's books to be found in the RNIB library. For more information, go to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999 and select option 5. You're listening to a special edition of Read On, RNIB's compendium of the best in books and reading. This week we're showcasing the novels on the shortlist for the Golden Man Booker Prize, celebrating 50 years of great writing by some of the world's finest authors, thanks to the support of the Booker Foundation, who fund the production of accessible versions of all the books on the shortlist each year. Readers with sight loss can enjoy the novels in contention for this prestigious award at the same time as their fellow book lovers and the judges. The book chosen as the Golden Man Booker from the 1990s is The English Patient by Michael Ondaatje. Here's Robert Kirkwood to tell us more.
The English Patient won the Man Booker Prize in 1992, an honour it shared with a book called Sacred Hunger by Parry Unsworth. It was only the second time that the prize was shared and will be the last, as the rules have now changed and there can only be one winner. The final curtain is closing on the Second World War, and Hannah, a nurse, stays behind in an abandoned Italian villa to tend her only remaining patient. Rescued by Bedouins from a burning plane, he is English, anonymous, damaged beyond recognition, and haunted by his memories of passion and betrayal. The only clue Hannah has to his past is the one thing he clung on to through the fire, a copy of the histories of Herodotus, covered with handwritten notes describing a painful and ultimately tragic love affair.
She has nursed him for months, and she knows the body well. The thin, tight hips. Hip bones of Christ, she thinks. He is her despairing saint. He lies flat on his back, no pillow, looking up at the foliage painted onto the ceiling, its canopy of branches, and above that, blue sky. She pours calamine in stripes across his chest, where he is less burnt, where she can touch him. She loves the hollow below the lowest rib, its cliff of skin. Reaching his shoulders, she blows cool air onto his neck, and he mutters. "What?" she asks, coming out of her concentration. He turns his dark face with its grey eyes towards her. She puts her hand into her pocket. She unskins the plum with her teeth, withdraws the stone, and passes the flesh of the fruit into his mouth. He whispers again, dragging the listening heart of the young nurse beside him to wherever his mind is, into that well of memory he kept plunging into during those months before he died.
Peter Wickham reading from Michael Ondaatje's The English Patient. The film of the book won the Best Oscar in 1996, and with all Booker books, it's available in Braille, giant print, and as talking book number 9654.
The English Patient was selected to represent the 1990s by novelist Camilla Shamsi. She called it that rare novel that gets under your skin and insists that you return to it time and again, always yielding a new surprise or delight. Here's what she had to say.
She stands up in the garden where she has been working and looks into the distance. She has sensed a shift in the weather. There's another gust of wind, a buckle of noise in the air, and the tall cypresses sway. I love judging this decade, and there are some just extraordinary novels in there. The English Patient stands out because it does everything. It has an astonishing cast of characters who you fall in love with and care deeply about. It's beautifully written, it's really intricately structured. It has a vast canvas, but it's also very intimate, and it makes you think quite a lot about things like war and friendship and love and nationalism. There are few books that still remain in the world that I look at and think of as a miracle, and this is one of them, and it should win, definitely.
Michael Ondaatje is one of the world's foremost authors, whose work has influenced an entire generation of writers. Although he's best known as a novelist, Ondaatje's work also encompasses poetry, memoir, and film. In fact, he's one of only two authors who's won both the Man Booker Prize and an Oscar.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB Library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB Library also caters for adults and children in both Braille and giant print, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB Library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
Eye health tips for summer. When choosing a pair of sunglasses this summer, it's important to check the level of UV protection they have. Always choose a pair that say UV 400 or 100% UV protection. There are eye shields available that fit over your existing glasses and wraparound designs that also stop UV rays getting in from the sides. There are a range of tints for eye shield lenses, such as yellow, that can increase contrast and aid focusing, and polarized lenses reduce glare from water, such as swimming pools and the ocean. Always ensure you're wearing eye protection when out in the sun this summer.
You're listening to a special edition of Read On, focusing on the five novels selected to vie for the Golden Man Booker Prize. Hilary Mantel is one of only three authors to have won the Man Booker Prize twice. The first time was in 2009 for Wolf Hall, and Robert Kirkwood interviewed her shortly after she was presented with the award. The novel is set in the 1520s at the court of King Henry VIII and follows the rapid rise to power of Thomas Cromwell, a man of humble origins and ruthless ambition.
"Stand up straight," Catherine murmurs, "like a princess of England." Braced against the chair back, Mary takes a deep breath. She turns to him, her plain, pinched face, hard as Norfolk's thumbnail. It is early afternoon, very hot. The sun casts against the wall shifting squares of lilac and gold. The shrivelled fields of Windsor are laid out below them. The Thames shrinks from its banks. The Queen speaks in English. "Do you know who this is? This is Master Cromwell, who now writes all the laws."
"Wolf Hall is a novel I've been thinking about for a long time, maybe 20-odd years. I've been thinking one of these days I'll get round to Thomas Cromwell. Thomas Cromwell, Henry VIII's minister, is the hero. He's at the centre of court affairs in the very busy decade of the 1530s, when he's Henry's right-hand man. But I take you back to his early life. Thomas Cromwell's background for a courtier was very unusual. He was born in Putney round about 1485. His father, Walter, was a brewer and a blacksmith. He was a violent man. He was a heavy drinker. Round about 15 years old, Thomas Cromwell ran away from home, crossed the Channel, joined the French army, then began on a series of adventures, about which we know startlingly little, except that they took him all over Europe. He came back to England in his late 20s, speaking many languages, and apparently knowing a bit about Well, most of the things you might want to know about. Finance, the cloth trade, commercial law. Went into the service of Cardinal Wolsey, and from there transferred into the King's service, and made the most amazing career, rising from his beginnings in the blacksmith's yard to be Earl of Essex.
It seems quite a mighty rise and rise, and he's been described as Alistair Campbell with an axe. Do you think that's a fair description?
I think Thomas Cromwell probably had a little bit more subtlety, at least than in our popular picture of Alistair Campbell. I would say the axe was hidden behind his back. But certainly he was a very powerful man. He was a very ruthless man. He wouldn't have been any use to a king like Henry VIII if he'd been any other way. He was also tremendously clever, quite charming, a good conversationalist, good company, well-read and interested in everything. Quite an appealing character in many ways, although in popular English history and in the novel, he's often painted as a kind of pantomime villain.
What I noticed from the novel is you may not like the decisions he's making, but you can see why he's making them.
Yes, the point is about this novel, you're standing in his shoes. So you are following him at every step of the twisty-turny political path. And you always have to say, in this situation, what would I do? Would I do any better?
Now, do you think our image of Cromwell has been tainted by the Robert Bolt play A Man for All Seasons?
Definitely. It's been influential as a play and as a film for two generations. It's very good drama, and that's why. As history, of course, it's hugely biased in favour of Thomas More. There's nothing particularly wrong with that, because a novelist or a dramatist really doesn't have to be impartial in the way that a historian has to, but I do think they have to be informed and they have to work on the basis of the facts. They must treat the facts honourably. Now, Bolt's version is highly partisan, but then so is my book. And I thought it's time we had another look at Thomas Cromwell. And my book isn't consciously an attempt to rehabilitate him. I doubt if he should need that. But it's an attempt to walk forward, as I say, imagining that you were in his shoes and seeing the world from his point of view. And from that point of view, Thomas More looks very different from the hero of Robert Bolt's play, who has, after all, not worn too well, because Robert Bolt's Thomas More is really a 1960s liberal. An idea which would have made the real Thomas More turn in his grave.
Now, how would you describe yourself then, as a historian or a novelist?
Oh, very much as a novelist. But I probably take the historical side of my work more seriously than many historical novelists. Because for me, it's the facts that spring imaginary constructs, that spring metaphor, its objects, documents, the source material, everything grows out of them, and artifacts like portraits and so on. So I have to have all the basic work in place, and I'll be pretty dogged in pursuing a fact that appears to be missing. But then, of course, we do come up against the gaps, to the great frustration of historians and biographers, as well as novelists. And it's just that I think there comes a point where the biographer, say, has to draw back and say, beyond this, it's mere speculation. But everybody knows that that's part of the novelist's trade. So you can push ahead into those dark areas and try to find out something of that life that we know must be there, but which hasn't come down to us, Cromwell, his public career is very well documented, but his private life, to a large extent, is hidden, and yet we know that it existed. Like everyone else, there was a personal side to his life. Like everyone else, he was seething with memories and dreams and maybe regrets and hopes for the future. So what the novelist can do on the basis of the fact, speculate about what these hopes and fears and dreams may have been and try and reconstruct a character from the inside.
Now, how long did it take to research this book?
Well, I have been thinking about it, as I explained, for quite a long time. But when I finally decided I was going to do it, and the time had come, I would say about 5 years in the research and writing.
Madam, shall we go on in English or Latin? Your cardinal would ask the same question, as if I were a stranger here. I will say to you, as I said to him, that I was first addressed as Princess of Wales when I was 3 years old. I was 16 when I came here to marry my Lord Arthur. I was a virgin and 17 when he died. I was 24 years old when I became Queen of England, and I will say, for the avoidance of doubt, that I am at present aged 46, and still Queen, and by now, I believe, a sort of Englishwoman.
So where does the title Wolf Hall come from?
Wolf Hall is the name of the Seymour's house in Wiltshire. It's still there, although nowadays there's a Victorian farmhouse on the site. But Wolf Hall, I liked it, you know, for its metaphorical resonance. In a sense, everywhere that Henry goes is Wolf Hall. He's surrounded by his predatory pack of snapping courtiers. But also Wolf Hall as a real house is the destination point of all the characters. At the very end of the book, Henry is off on his summer holidays, summer progress. He's going to travel across the West Country. And one of the places he's going to visit when he's on his way back to London, he's got 4 or 5 days, early September, and he's going to go to Wolf Hall. And that's how the book ends, with Cromwell writing the itinerary and writing in these words, Wolf Hall. And I like the idea of a book that was always in progress, right till its final two words.
So what do you think her fascination with the Tudors is?
Well, they certainly have a kind of soap opera element written into them. You see, this story, King has 6 wives, kills 2 of them, divorces 2 of them. You couldn't make it up. You absolutely couldn't. People would accuse you of being melodramatic. And yet, these are the facts of English history. So, I think we're brought very close to these people on a human level. Even though the Tudors were very different from us, there is something in common in the psychological setup here. Henry was a very modern man in many ways. He was a great romantic. And in an age of arranged marriages, Henry wanted to be in love with his wives. So when he wanted to get rid of his first wife, Catherine of Aragon, the fact that he'd long ago fallen out of love with her was part of it, I think. And his plan, because he didn't have a son to succeed him, his fellow monarchs sympathised. Even the Pope could have been brought to sympathise. Annulments like that were granted all the time. So Henry's path should have been easy. But he went and fell in love with a totally unsuitable woman. Not the French princess everyone expected him to marry, but Anne Boleyn, the daughter of a mere gentleman, with something of a past, something of a question mark, certainly, hanging over her sexual history. So falling in love was what really complicated Henry's life. Then he fell out of love and developed a great passion for Jane Seymour, who was going to be wife number 3. And in the course of time, a marriage was arranged to Anne of Cleves, whom he couldn't love at all. Of course, the men of his generation didn't understand his hesitation. Why didn't he just hop into bed with the girl and do the business? But Henry wasn't like that. His psychology wasn't set up that way. We've all known, I think, women who are something like Henry's first wife, Catherine of Aragon, in that they're a career wife and they'll hang on to a dead marriage. And we've all known someone like Anne Boleyn, who's the mistress on the make. So even though there's a yawning gap of 500 years, we can still look at the world about us and we can find comparisons. What we have to remember, of course, is that Henry didn't know he was going to have six wives. Even when he was up to wife number five, he didn't know it. So we have to get rid of any idea that these things were preordained and see these people as human beings moving through history with no foresight, only a lot of muddle and misinformation around them. And I think this period of history, because it's so personal, it makes it very human. And also there's another thing about Henry's reign which is interesting, in that women have been bit players in the English monarchy until now. But suddenly a woman and her body and what her body can do is centre stage. It's the absolutely vital factor, because what Henry needs and wants more than anything is a son and the woman who will give him a son. And the whole politics of the reign begin to centre around this question of a woman's body.
Hilary Mantel, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you, Rob.
Thanks to Robert Kirkwood. Wolf Hall was chosen as the best winner from the noughties by novelist and broadcaster Simon Mayo, who said that, in its questioning of what England is and how it can disengage from Rome, Wolf Hall is a book as anguished as any essay about Brexit that you'll read in the papers. Here he is to tell us more.
Imagine writing down such a charge and taking it to the printer and circulating it through the court and through the realm, putting it out there to where people will believe anything, putting it out there to the shepherds on the hills, to Tyndale's ploughboy, to the beggar on the roads and the patient beast in its byre or stall, out there to the bitter winter winds and to the weak early sun and the snowdrops in the London gardens. It's been wonderfully terrible, extraordinarily difficult, because they're all winners, obviously. I love historical fiction, and Hilary Mantel is in charge here. It manages to be fantastically readable and unbelievably complicated and very straightforward and very dense, but it stays with you. It's an astonishing achievement to make the distance between the 16th century and the 21st century like that, like it doesn't exist.
Wolf Hall and its sequel, Bring Up the Bodies, are both available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB library. Now, bringing us right up to date, Lincoln in the Bardo by George Saunders is the most recent winner of the Man Booker Prize, and it was selected by poet Holly McNeish as the Golden Booker of the 2010s. Although he's well known as a short story writer, this was Saunders' first full-length novel. In her judge's note, McNeish said, "I've never read a book like Lincoln in the Bardo. It was so funny, imaginative and tragic, but also a piece of genius in its originality of form and structure." And here's Holly McNeish to give us a taste of the book and how she went about selecting it.
On our wedding day, I was 46, she was 18. Now, I know what you're thinking. Older man. Not thin, somewhat bald, lame in one leg, teeth of wood, exercises the marital prerogative, thereby mortifying the poor young. But that is false. That is exactly what I refused to do, you see. On our wedding night, I clumped up the stairs, face red with drink and dance, found her arrayed in some thinnish thing an aunt had forced her into, silk collar fluttering slightly with her quaking, and could not do it. Pretty difficult, reading And that many books in a short space of time was pretty hard. Loads of the other stories I found fascinating and interesting and really captivating. I think George Saunders with the book has invented a new kind of literary level with novels. I think it must be quite hard to kind of break boundaries in that way now, and I think this has done it.
Lincoln in the Bardo is the tale of Abraham Lincoln and his son, Willie, who died aged 11 on the eve of the American Civil War. Told over the course of a single night, it is a story of love and loss that breaks free of realism to enter a bizarre and supernatural domain. Willie Lincoln finds himself trapped in a transitional realm, called in Tibetan tradition, the Bardo. And as ghosts mingle, squabble, gripe and commiserate, and stony tendrils creep towards the boy, a monumental struggle erupts over young Willie's soul. Robert Kirkwood discussed the book with George Saunders shortly before his victory was announced last year.
It's a novel, and it all takes place on one night. And the idea is based on an anecdote I heard many years ago, and the anecdote is this. Abraham Lincoln, when he was president during the Civil War, lost his son. His 11-year-old son died of typhoid. And the newspaper accounts at the time said that he'd been so grief-stricken that he actually went into the grave or the crypt on several occasions to sort of interact with the body. Some accounts said he actually picked it up. So I heard that about 20 years ago, and it just stayed with me all this time. And I, you know, didn't really think I could write it. And then about 2012, I just decided that, you know, if it had been on my mind that long, I should give it a try. So the book is really just that night on which Lincoln comes to this place called Oak Hill Cemetery in Washington, D.C., and he enters the crypt, and then, you know, hilarity ensues.
Now, you're not known to be a religious writer, but what is a bardo?
Well, bardo is a Tibetan word that means transitional state. So we're in one right now, you know, a transition between birth and death. And there are several others, but the book is concerned with the transition between the zone between the moment of your death and then whatever comes next, which in the Tibetan tradition would be, of course, reincarnation. But if you're a Christian, it might be heaven or hell. So bardo kind of means that. And then I also took it to mean, you know, Lincoln himself was in a transition. He had to sort of quickly go from being a grieving father back to being a kind of active president. So the night is sort of a almost like a, you know, for him, a chance to sort of take a breath and try to get back into the real world and out of that graveyard.
And the structure of the book, it's almost like you've invented a new form, and it hasn't been written, it's been crafted almost. Tell us about how you decided on that structure.
Yeah, that's a great question. I wouldn't say decided, unless decided was defined as, you know, kind of messing around for 3 or 4 months or maybe even a year. I think... for me, I tried this book in a more traditional way many years ago, kind of a standard third-person narration, and it just didn't have any life in it, you know. And I mostly write short stories, and the one thing I learned is if it's boring for me, it's going to be boring for the reader. So, or, you know, Flannery O'Connor, this great American writer, said once, a person can choose what he writes, but he can't choose what he makes live. So for me, the compositional method is always to just try to find a way to tell the story that makes me happy and makes me maybe confused and excited. So the short version is this was just a product of mucking around trying to find a way to tell the story that was interesting to me. And in the end, the solution was to let it be this kind of chorus of monologues, partly, I think, because, you know, in a sense, to me, that's the truest version of human life is bunch of monologues. You know, if I look out the window here in London, there's 40 or 50 people walking by. The God's eye view of that is actually just 40 inner monologues, you know, at once. Sometimes they contradict each other. Sometimes they don't seem to even be observing the same reality. But it was just an exciting way for me to tell the story. It almost looks like a screenplay, some people said, or a theatrical script.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see the Braille version to see how it's translated to... a tactile form, but it certainly doesn't. Well, the audio version couldn't be narrated by just one person, could it?
Well, that originally that was the plan, and I just was so terrified of that because I can only do maybe 2 or 3 distinct voices. You know, I can do a guy from Brooklyn, and you know, southern voice and a duck or something like that. So I didn't want to do it. So we had this wonderful young woman named Kelly Gilday in Los Angeles had the idea that maybe we could enlist actors. And she actually went off and made a spreadsheet. And she came back on the phone and said, well, we'll need 166 people. I said, well, can we get that? She said, well, we can try. So we got some really wonderful professional actors and then some voice actors and then some people from Random House and my agent. And then we got my family members. And so we just barely made the 166. But there's not a single double voice on the tape. So in other words, every voice that's in the book is represented by a distinct actor in the audiobook.
And would we know some of the actors who are involved?
Yes, I think Ben Stiller, Susan Sarandon, Don Cheadle, Miranda July, Nick Offerman and Megan Mullally, and then David Sedaris plays one of the main parts. So there's quite a list, maybe probably I would say 20 or 30 very famous actors are kind of headlining.
And they all recorded their lines individually?
That's right. They were never in the same... None of us were in the studio at the same time. And I think they ended up using, I think she told me, 11 different locations. She would Skype, you know, you could go to Minneapolis and Skype in, and my parents went to New Orleans and Skyped in. So it was a Herculean effort, but not by me. Someone else did it all.
Have you read the audio versions of your previous work?
Well, I had 10th of December, and then I think I did one other version. I did two other books. I didn't get through the whole catalog yet. But yeah, 10th of December was kind of the most... highly produced one.
And when you're actually writing, is hearing it out loud, even internally, important to the writing process?
It's very important. I'm from Chicago, and for me, the kind of entrance into writing was to understand it as a form of performance. So when we were kids, we did a lot of kind of, you know, improvising and impersonating and that kind of thing. So I had a long time in my life when I was younger where I couldn't figure out how to write, really. I had a little bit of a false version of how to do it. But as soon as I thought, oh, yeah, it's just a performance, then it was easy. I don't usually read, well, as you say, internally is more correct. I don't read aloud. You know, there's that little voice in your head that is a little actually more subtle than your speaking voice, you know, and can get into different registers and do different accents. So that voice is very active for me. So I tend to write, and then as I'm reading, I'm hearing that voice in my mind and adjusting the text to match the voice and so on. And then also, I've been, you know, when I go to colleges or I travel, I do, I try to develop performance versions of the stories where I learn to do the voices as well as I can and then kind of go back and forth to make it lively for the audience.
Now, let's know, you said you wrote short stories. You're described as the master of the short story. So it's a missed opportunity if I don't ask you this. RNIB have a writing competition each year. What are some top tips you would give to people who are potentially thinking about entering that competition?
Sure. Well, that's a great question. I think for me, the big leap forward was when I realized that a short story is not necessarily... how would I say it? It's a strange little machine that we make. It's almost like a song or a poem. It has a resemblance to real life, but it isn't necessarily a linear representation of real life. So, or the other comparison would be to a joke. You know, a joke often doesn't have much to do with real life. It isn't. You know, it's more compressed and it's sillier. But when you're telling the joke, you're really concentrating on the last moment. You know, when you get to the punchline, if the person laughs, then you win, and if they don't, then you lose. So the story is a very similar medium, actually. There's usually one moment in the story that's kind of the payoff moment, and nothing else really matters except for that payoff. So to me, it was very useful to think of it as a kind of a machine, a strange little device that's there to, you know, to create human emotion. The other more quotidian thing would be just that most of the story writers I know who are good, they just do a lot of revision. You know, it's not the case that they just blur something out, but you do blur something out, and then you go back to it again and again and again and try to find what it is really trying to say to you. And that's just a kind of a, you know, a sweat equity sort of a thing. You're really doing hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of rewrites to try to let the story talk to you directly.
How many times did you go back to and rewrite Lincoln and the Bardo?
It would be hard to count. It was a 4-year effort, and every section was rewritten, you know, at least dozens of times, and then whole sections were taken out and put back in, and things were moved around, and so it was kind of a, you know, I'm sure thousands of drafts. I like that the model of writing that is, you know, kind of led by iteration. So you keep coming back to it every day, and gradually it changes shape into what you like. It. The example I always use is if you had a hotel room, or let's say that I gave you an apartment, I bought it for you and gave it to you, and I furnished it nicely. Although that would be a nice gesture, you would go into the apartment and you wouldn't feel at home. This isn't your style. So revising is like if I let you, you know, every day for 3 years, take out one thing that I bought for you and exchange it for something that you like better. You know, all the pictures, all the knickknacks, the blankets, everything in the house. After that 3 years, the place would have you in every cranny, you know. You would have totally infused that room with yourself. Rewriting is like that. You know, you throw down a first draft, that's kind of like that initial apartment. But then every day when you come back and make changes to taste, the thing starts to really have your essence in it. For me anyway, that I can't do that unless I work on something for years and years over and over.
George Sanders, thank you so much for joining me today on RNIB Connect Radio.
It's such a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks to Robert and to George Saunders. I hope the throat's better, Robert. Lincoln in the Bardo is available in Braille, giant print, and as TB23946 from the RNIB Library. Alongside it, thanks to the continuing support of the Booker Foundation, you'll also find accessible versions of all the books shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize for the last 15 years, and all 51 of the winners. For more information, go to the library website, rniblibrary.com, or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999 and select option 5. As to who's going to be the overall winner of the Golden Man Booker Prize, there's not long to wait now. Tune in to Read On at the same time next week when we will bring you the result of the Golden Man Booker and of the RNIB Creative Writing Competition. Or, if you're listening to the podcast, you'll find it wherever you found this. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, packed with book news, reviews, and exclusive author interviews. You'll find a link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk, or you can find producer Robert on Twitter at talking_books. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.